Welcome back. This is The Last Savior. I'm with Dr. Karimi. We're discussing the timing of uprising of Yamanis through Sunni sources. Well, Dr. Karimi, before going to the break, you discussed three groups of Sunnis who have contradicting views. Some say that Qahtani is going to come after Imam Mehdi. Some say Qahtani is going to come before Imam Mehdi. And there's another group who again says Qahtani is going to come before Imam Mehdi. Qahtani is same as Yamani. And there's third group which says Qahtani is going to come at the same time when Imam Mehdi is going to come.
Yeah, and yet the fourth narration in this regard is a bit weird one, because according to that narration, Qahtani is the same as Imam Mehdi, so they are not two people.
All right.
We have one narration in this regard. Al-Qahtani rajulun salih. Qahtani is a righteous man. Wa huwa alladhi yusalli khalfahu Isa. He is the man behind whom Jesus alayhi salam will say his prayer. Wa huwa al-Mahdi. He is the promised Mahdi. Of course, I'm not saying that the Sunni scholars, they believe in all these contradicting narrations. The point is that, and maybe for many of Sunni scholars, many of such narrations are not authentic, and many of them are not quoted from the Prophet. They are just quoted in some of the Sunni sources. But the point is that when we refer to Sunni sources, and when it comes to the time of the uprising of Yamani, we see such a kind of contradiction. As I mentioned, a group of narrations say that he will come after the reappearance of Imam Mahdi. The second
some
group claim that he will come
before.
The third says that they will come at the same time. And the fourth group says that they are not different. They are
the
same people.
Okay.
So, of course, that was just for the information of the dear listeners. When it comes to Shia sources, as I mentioned, the uprising of Yamani or Qahtani is one of the signs for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, which means that we cannot agree with the narrations which tell us that Yamani will come after the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
Okay.
And also the narrations which tell us that Yamani is going to come at the same time as the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is not also acceptable. Based on Shia sources, we can only accept the viewpoint according to which
one group
he will come before the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
Because that's considered as the signs.
Exactly, the signs of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. But his uprising is very close to the time of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi, and also very close to the uprising of Sufyani, or on the same day. They will come, they will fight each other, and after maybe a couple of months, we will have the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. So we had some discussions about the whether Yamani is one of the definite signs for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, about the names and titles of him, and lastly, we talked about the time of his uprising. And the next discussion, which is also very important, is about the place of his uprising and whether we need to go and help Yamani or not. This is a very interesting topic that,
yes,
inshallah, we'll discuss about
that.
That
would be,
sessions.
That be considered among our duties,
exactly,
or not? So that's very, very important, because to be a soldier of Imam, you need to be knowing what are my duties, what I have to do, who I have to fight with, who I have to be a companion with. Well, Dr. Karimi, we discussed a lot of groups, Sunni groups, who say that Imam is same as Qahtani. That was fourth group. We reject that completely. The third group says that Qahtani and Imam are going to come at same time. We also reject that. Or Qahtani is going to come before Imam Mehdi. We accept this one. And Qahtani is going to come after Imam Mehdi. We do not accept that again. So we only, as Shias, we only accept one of the debates, that is Qahtani, which is Yamani, is going to come before Imam Mehdi. Thank you so much, Dr. Karimi. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio.
Midstream.
Since 2011, Turkey has been the main destination for people fleeing the war in Syria. According to the latest official statistics, the number of Syrian refugees in Turkey is close to 4 million, while the real number is believed to be higher than that. Turkey has always been the main supporter of insurgents in the cities and towns bordering Syria, as it has been hosting the National Coalition for Syrian Revolutionary and Opposition Forces for years, and it has been the main sponsor of what was initially known as the Free Syrian Army that eventually broke into several smaller groups of armed insurgents. However, feelings of hostility to refugees have escalated in Turkey in recent years, with a number of politicians campaigning to impose stricter restrictions on Syrian refugees, which has contributed to an increase in feelings of hatred towards them, as they constitute the largest percentage of refugees in the country. Events escalated to vandalizing and burning Syrian properties and shops after multiple episodes of chants calling for the expulsion of Syrians from the country prior to the start of matches in sports stadiums. The feelings of sympathy and brotherhood that the Turkish community showed towards the refugees in the first years of the war in Syria turned into more hostile ones against them, especially recently after the explosion in the famous Istiklal Street in the city center, which was pinned on allegedly a Syrian woman. The explosion killed six Turks and injured more than 50 civilians, according to official statements of the Turkish government, which in turn announced the responsibility of the Democratic Union Party PYD, an arm of the Kurdistan Workers' Party PKK, for the explosion, both of which are on Ankara's lists of terrorism and are active in the regions of northern Syria and Iraq. The bombing came amid complex circumstances in which Turkey is witnessing sharp political polarization with the approaching general elections scheduled for the summer of 2023 and an economic crisis resulting from high inflation rates globally. The issue of the Syrian refugees is at the top of that political division in the country, and the Istiklal bombing came along to make things worse. Residents of Istanbul and other Turkish cities which witness a large Syrian presence have noticed the change in popular mood since the loss of the ruling party in Turkey, the Justice and Development Party, in the municipal elections in 2018. Those areas gradually witnessed an increase in incidents of racism after the emergence of new political figures that practiced clear racism even against refugees who hold the Turkish citizenship. In the meantime, it seems that pinning the bombing that hit one of the most important and famous streets in Istanbul on a Syrian national while blaming the PKK for it will be sufficient justification for Turkey to launch its new illegal military operation in Syria, which most probably will lead to more racism inside Turkey. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Mara Osman. Efforts to raise awareness about the seriousness of hate speech to which Syrians in Turkey are subjected have not limited violent incidents. Some of them held the government and organizations responsible for their insufficient interest in curbing this discourse. The fears of Syrian refugees in Turkey are increasing in light of the growing hate speech against them to the point of threatening their lives, and the country has recorded several murders due to hate and racism. In this context, they call on those who defend them and their right to live away from the dangers of arrest or killing. To discuss this issue with us from Berlin is Gevork Almasyan, founder of Syriana Analysis News Channel on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Telegram. You can also find his reels and shorts on various social media platforms. Thank you very much for being with us, Gevork. Now, given last week's attack in Istanbul's main tourist attraction street, Istiklal Street, which supposedly saw a Syrian woman behind that attack, and even before said attack, aggression and racism against Syrian refugees inside Turkey have been rising. As per your follow-up on that matter, what are the reasons behind such violence against Syrian refugees inside of Turkey?
Thank you very much, Marwa, for having me on your show. It's a great pleasure and an honor, and I think it's a very important topic to cover. We need to shed light on this issue because it could have regional and geopolitical repercussions in the coming few weeks and months. First of all, there is a big question mark, and that is the woman who committed this horrendous crime in Istanbul a Syrian citizen? Because according to my observation, from her facial features, and I'm not talking about her skin color, she doesn't look like Syrian to me. I have lived in Syria for over 20 years, and I didn't come across such facial features, and even among the Kurdish population there. So in my opinion, the claims that she was Syrian and trained by the PKK, it needs investigation. We cannot really rely on the Turkish, I would say, narrative that this woman has been trained in Syria, she is Syrian, and she came from a PKK side in order to commit a terrorist attack there. Let's be clear, this attack is condemned. There is no explanation for or excuse for blowing up innocent citizens anywhere around the world. However, we have to understand why this is happening right now. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, this narrative of the Turkish official or Turkish officials aims at increasing the level of hatred against the Syrian community in Turkey. And the reason behind it is, since 2011, there was a big investment in the refugees, not only in Turkey, but in the entire region and also in Europe, because they wanted to weaponize the refugees against Syria. And they used the refugee crisis or the refugee card as a bargaining chip with the Syrian side. Mm-hmm. And now they, all the time, they talk about that we may recognize the legitimacy of the Syrian government if we return back the Syrian refugees again. So the Syrian side, of course, has its preconditions for accepting over 2.5-3 million refugees to Syria, because Turkish side is occupying northern Syria, so they have to withdraw from certain areas. They have to also clean Idlib from the radical jihadists, as Turkey promised and signed on agreements. So now,
at the moment, Kevork, they're actually doing the opposite of that, directly the opposite of that. But I mean, resentment is high, but there is also struggle. There is economic struggle inside of Turkey as well. Turkey has enough economic and security problems to deal with. Why use the refugee card in such an election that's coming up next year as a hot topic?
Actually, any government, without exception, when they fail in the domestic affairs, especially on the economic level, they try to export the crisis into the outside of the territories, or for the Turkish case, is into Syria. And the refugees are the weakest, I would say, part of this equation. Therefore, it's very easy to blame the Syrian refugees in Turkey for causing all these troubles, in economic troubles in Turkey. And unfortunately, there is an increased nationalistic, religious, and ethnic and sectarian negative sentiments against the Syrians. And let's remember, this is not new. Even under the Ottoman Empire, they used to call they used to insult the Arab people for just being an Arab. And now, if you go to Turkey, you will see that there is a state policy through the media and through the organizations and through their presence, political presence underground, to increase this hatred against the Syrians, because they want to kick them out of the country without, I would say, political agreement with the Syrian side and without coordination with the Syrian side. And this is, in my opinion, is impossible, and it will cause more troubles in Turkey, because, in my opinion, they are also considerable part of the Syrian refugees in Turkey. They are pro al-Nusra, pro FSA, etc. And these people could cause also security troubles in Turkey itself. However, since there is elections coming in the next year, and Erdogan is his win is not guaranteed in the next elections, so he is promising his people that he will get rid of at least 1 million Syrian refugees in the coming weeks and months. So this is one of the reasons why the leadership in Turkey is using the refugee card as a bargaining chip, or as using the conflict to export the troubles that they have in Turkey into the Syrian scene. Now, by accusing the PKK or the Kurdish militias in Syria, the Erdogan will have another excuse to invade more territories in Syria, and he will have more acceptance among the Turkish people to go after the Kurdish militias in Syria, because they want to combat, quote-unquote, terrorism in Syria. Mm-hmm. So I see from this point of view that Turkey wants to occupy more territories in Syria and also expel the refugees from their territories, and they use this case particularly to do that.
I don't know how actually viable that option is for Turkey, especially when things are turning around inside Syria towards the government side. But for its own reasons, the Turkish government now is making plans to return at least 1 million Syrian refugees back home to Syria. Is that a bad thing? I mean, if Syria is ready to accept these refugees, then why is most of the anti-government media in Turkey considering it, I mean, anti-Syrian government media considering it to be an evil plan?
Actually, let's see the political scene in Turkey. There is a consensus among all political parties in Turkey, whether in the government or in the opposition, that they want to return the refugees to Syria. Is this a good thing or not? It's a double-edged sword, as we say in Arabic, because from one hand, Turkey used the refugees as a weapon, weaponized the refugees against Syria. And on the other hand, the Syrian side wants to also take away this bargaining chip from the Turkish hands, right? Because for Syria, yes, they are suffering from economic crisis in Syria, but at the same time, they know that 3 million refugees in Turkey will always be a political pressure card against the Syrian side, because all the parties who are involved in the war in Syria, especially the anti-government side, they say, look, there are millions of refugees outside the country, and they say all of them are against Assad, so or the Syrian government, so the government doesn't have legitimacy. So also the Syrian side has an interest for receiving these refugees. However, through coordination, through political deals with the Turkish side, and I think if Turkey wants to now invade northern Syria again, some the parts that they don't occupy, and return the refugees, now will come the role of Russia to mediate between the Syrian side and the Turkish side to say, look, you can return the refugees, but you have to coordinate with the Syrian side. You have to deal with the Syrian side. You should withdraw your forces, and in exchange, you can send the refugees back, and the Syrian side will receive them and allow them to live in dignity. And let's remember, President of Syria, Bashar Assad, he issued a presidential pardon only a few months ago for crimes related to terrorism, exception for people who killed someone or murdered someone. Mm-hmm. And this is a signal to the Syrian, message to the Syrian refugees in Turkey that they can come back to Syria, even if they were involved in funding terrorism or being part of the revolutionary so-called committees, and they're working in media, etc., etc., and they were supporting the terrorists in Syria. So this is a message to the refugees, this is a message to Turkey that the Syrian side is ready for a compromise, but this should be on the terms of the Syrian side and not Turkey invading these territories, creating the so-called safe zones, and returning the refugees against their will to Syria. There is a sovereign nation in Syria, and there is a sovereign government in Syria, and they have to deal with that, and I think
and
Russia
I think that,
has to play a role
if
in
that
this.
Is done the way that Turkey wants it, again, I think it is also against international law itself, the law that protects refugees of war. I want to thank you very much, Gevorg Almasan. It's never enough time when we have this kind of one-on-one interview with you, but thank you very much, founder of Syriana Analysis News Channel, on all of social media, for being with us and for your contribution. Now, please stay tuned, because next we want to talk about what really is happening inside of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
People of Iranian Khuzestan, in a majestic scene, mourn the martyrs of the terrorist attack in the city of Izeh, southwestern Iran. The people of Khuzestan from all cities and nationalities came to the city of Izeh to mourn the martyrs of the terrorist attack that targeted Iranian civilians last week. Now, the mourners condemned the terrorist attack, renewing allegiance to the Islamic Republic and Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The mourners also called on the authorities to impose the most severe penalties on the perpetrators of the terrorist attack, which claimed the lives of seniors, youth, and even young children. Western-backed terrorism inside of Iran in this following report.
We all have been following the insane Western media frenzy against Iran over the past month. But what exactly is going on inside the Islamic Republic of Iran? According to security data shared by the Iranian authorities, during the recent riots that affected some Iranian cities, 40 Western countries were found to have been responsible for the funding, training, and arming of rioters in an attempt to stimulate the scenario of Syria inside Iran. Those 40 countries, on top of whom are the United States of America, Britain, Israel, and Germany, are preparing a terrible scenario to destabilize Iran, dismantle its regime, and overthrow the Islamic Republic. But little do they understand the ideology of the Iranian population. Despite the continuous falsified news propagated by 260 different media channels funded by the West, some Persian Gulf Arab states, and the Zionist lobby against the Islamic Republic of Iran, the holy city of Mashhad, the city of Izeh, and the city of Sahne all witnessed last week solemn funerals for the martyrs who fell as a result of the terrorist attacks that took place in the city. The cities witnessed large crowds. Bodies of the martyrs were spread to their final resting place as the people vowed to avenge their fallen by standing against the U.S.-instigated regime change attempts. Iran reserves its right to pursue these terrorist operations legally and judicially, to hold the perpetrators and the governments that support them accountable as per what the international law states. It is only fair that Iran does everything in its power to protect the rights of the Iranian people. Such sovereign notions seem to be so far unclear enough for the Biden administration and its allies. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian accused the usual perp in West Asia, Israel, along with the Western intelligence agencies, of planning to divide Iran and ignite a civil war in it, stressing that the Iranians will not be deceived by such plans. Meanwhile, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, affirmed the failure of those behind the recent riots to drag people into the streets, stressing that these actions will undoubtedly end and that the Iranian people will continue to advance with more determination and persistence. Iran's enemies have harnessed all their energies, including their media, in order to harm national unity and weaken the will of Iranian people to defend the country's frontiers. But they suffered defeat once again in front of the vigilance and foresight of the cohesive Iranian people. American neocons planned behind the scenes the unrest and the riots to try and strip the Iranian nationals of their national identity and true culture, and thus turn them into a tool in the service of their hateful goals. Yet once again, the Iranian people with all their ethnicities and sects were able to thwart this scheme.
To discuss this issue with us from Tehran is Professor Sayyid Mohammad Mirandi, academic at Tehran University and political analyst. Thank you very much for being with us, Professor, as always. Now, several terrorist attacks have hit the Iranian cities of Izeh, Isfahan, and Mashhad. The obvious international silence of foreign perpetrators and promoters of violence inside Iran carries no message other than promoting terrorism in the world. Yet they preach human rights by cutting their hair in the West and in alleged support for a young woman who tragically passed away due to prior health conditions in Iran. Now, can you explain this moral contradiction?
I think it's very obvious. The very same countries that have supported the coup in Iran in 1953 and who imposed the Shah on the Iranian people and during the revolution supported the Shah when he was gunning down people on the streets with the army, the same people who supported Saddam Hussein during the war, gave him chemical weapons, and sanctioned women and children in Iran for years now, these are the people who are talking about human rights. So I think it's clear for all of us that when Western countries, Western regimes speak of human rights, they're just being hypocritical and they are basically trying to cover up their own crimes, whether it's in Yemen or in Syria or Vietnam or Nicaragua and Venezuela and Cuba. It doesn't matter whether it's Libya or South Africa, again, doesn't matter. Those countries that violate human rights more than any other are Western governments, Western regimes. And those countries who pretend that they are morally superior than all others are the very same Western countries and those regimes that rule over those countries.
Well, Professor, the head of the intelligence of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps in the city of Sahna in Kermanshah province, Colonel Nadal Bayrami, was martyred at the hands of rioters as well last week. This comes after two members of the Iranian Mobilization Forces and two other members of the Border Guard Forces were also killed in two separate attacks in Iran. Now, a week prior to Mr. Bayrami's martyrdom, such high-profile targets cannot be simply led by rioters. It has to be intel work. Can Iran face such advanced level of terrorism?
He wasn't a high-ranking official. He was in charge of intelligence for a very small city. Mm-hmm. I don't think that they have been able to make any serious inroads with regards to assassinating or targeting high-ranking officials. So far there's been no sign of that. What they are trying to do is they're trying to create fear among ordinary Iranians. And they're very brutal. The way in which they murder people is not just by shooting them. They beat them to death. They burn people alive. They slit people by the throat.
Daesh style.
Yes, they behave very much like Daesh, actually, even though they are supposedly secular, but their behavior is very much like Daesh. Mm-hmm. They're very brutal, very cruel, very barbaric. And they've murdered police officers, they've murdered Basij volunteers, and Western Persian language media eggs them on. They even, in their reports, legitimize murder. They legitimize burning people alive. They legitimize stabbing police officers. This is what Persian language media based in London does. Yet no one in the West will stop them. No one will complain about it. No human rights organization will say a word about it. And of course, Ofcom in London will not take a stand. If the things that BBC Persian and the Saudi TV channel Iran International or Manoto and the other media outlets that are in the West, mostly in London, the big ones, but there are literally hundreds of TV channels and media channels in Iran funded by Western regimes and Saudi Arabia. If they were in English and they were directed at an English audience or an English-speaking audience, those TV channels would be shut down immediately, and these people would be taken to court.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, definitely. I mean, Press TV is just trying to tell the truth, and they still put sanctions on us, and they try to silence us. So go figure what would happen if there were 216 of us, the same number that they have against the native Iranians. But Professor Mirendi, in like 2 minutes, we heard Iranian Foreign Minister Mr. Hossein Amir Abdullahian accusing Israel and Western intelligence services of planning to divide Iran and to ignite a sectarian civil war inside of Iran, stressing that the Iranians will not be deceived by such plans. Does that mean that Iran will not stop at only eradicating terrorism internally? Will it go after maybe also foreign enablers too?
Iran is already doing that. The terrorist organizations that are being funded by the United States, the United Arab Emirates, NATO regimes and Israelis, they're based in northern Iraq. And they have many bases there, and they are very well equipped. So the Iranians are targeting them because they're sending weapons into the country, they're sending terrorists into the country in order to carry out sabotage. There's no doubt that these riots have failed, and Iran is very stable, and nothing is going to happen. But what Iran will do is that it will punish these countries. Those countries that have been involved, that are closer to home, they will feel Iran's wrath more quickly. But all of them will ultimately pay a price. Mm-hmm. Iran is very patient, but Iran will ultimately punish these countries. these regimes.
Well, in less than 30 minutes, could you give us just an eye of what's going on in the streets? I mean, the lies that we hear on the media brings thought and images of, for example, Dar'a in Syria happening right now in the streets of Tehran. What can you tell us about that?
Well, Iran is not Syria. The Islamic Republic of Iran is extremely powerful. It has a very high degree of popular legitimacy. We saw that 3 years ago when General Soleimani was martyred by the U.S. regime. We saw the millions of people in Tehran and millions of others in other cities participating in his funeral, and in Iraq as well. These are the same people. The United States is trying. This is their last attempt because they have so much difficulties, so many difficulties to deal with Russia, with China, and with their own internal difficulties. I don't think in future they're going to be able to mobilize resources like they have been against Iran over the past few years. I think this was their last big attempt to bring about change in Iran. And from the very beginning, it was clear that it would fail utterly.
Well, let them just wait till the third day of the new year and they'll see what the Iranian people have to say about that when they commemorate the third anniversary of the martyrdom of Hajj Qasem Soleimani. I want to thank you very much, Professor Sayyid Mohammed Marandi, academic at Tehran University and political analyst, for joining us to tell us what's actually going on inside of Iran. Thank you for following us. Thank you for believing in our reports, because we do tell the truth because we have nothing to lose. We tell you the truth because the West lies. The West propagates fake news, and you get the truth right here. See you again next week. Assalamu alaikum.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
عفت و حیا این نیست که فقط تو جمع که دیگران ما رو میبینن آدم خودشو حفظ بکنه.
Chastity and honor does not mean to only cover yourself when you're surrounded by the non-mahrams. Chastity has different degrees, the best of which is when you are alone and in solitude. This means not to let satanic temptations when we are alone. This is the best type of chastity.
عرض کردم این صفت صفتی است که هم مرد مؤمن و هم زن مؤمن بهش احتیاج داره ولی به خصوص زنان.
Chastity is for both men and women. However, women are in more need of it. That's why in a supplication by Imam al-Mahdi in Mafatih al-Janan we read, O Allah, bestow our women honor and chastity. This fragment shows the great importance of chastity for women in a society. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
According to analysts, the crisis of gas shortages in Europe and the possibility of citizens turning to electric heating devices will put Europe on the verge of widespread blackouts. They say next winter we will see larger regional blackouts in Europe. The risk of industrial closures, power outages, and blackouts due to gas shortages lurks among European citizens in the cold winter, which can also lead to regional tensions. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Berlin-based newspaper Welt am Sonntag writes, a German official sounded the alarm warning of serious electricity shortage in the country and across the region. Rolf Tissler, president of the German Federal Office for Civil Protection and Disaster Assistance, said, "We have to assume that there will be big blackouts in winter." Tissler said, "We have to expect blackouts in winter. By this I mean a regional and temporary interruption in the power supply," adding that the power cuts were due to both energy shortages and temporary shutdowns of the entire grid to protect the entire network. The official further added that he was referring to short-term power outages, so-called brownouts, rather than larger-scale blackouts. Tissler warned that the situation could potentially reach a critical point, urging Germans to stock up on food, water, and other essential supplies. Tissler said the last couple of years have been really tough for Germans, adding that the COVID-19 pandemic served as a prime example of the unforeseen effects of a crisis. Tissler pointed out the coming years are yet to be more challenging in light of the worsening climate situation and other serious and geopolitical tensions. He said the saddest part of the news was the European Union at the confederal level denies the hardships that normal people were going to face in winter. In related news, a major German grid operator told media in early October that the country may be forced this year to cut its electricity exports to other countries in order to survive in winter. Hendrik Naumann, chief technical officer of German electricity grid operator Amprion, told the Financial Times about potentially cutting off electricity exports to other countries to avoid local shortages. Naumann said in an interview that temporarily pausing exports of electricity for hours rather than days could be a last resort to salvage the country's embattled energy crisis, which has been in the eyes of the storm since gas supplies from Russia were cut. France and Austria are the biggest importers of Germany's surplus electric power, whose energy crises could deteriorate with any switch off of German exports. Naumann said the Ukraine crisis was one of the numerous overlapping issues contributing to Europe's energy crisis, worsened by the shutdown of over half of France's 56 nuclear power plants and low water levels on main rivers delaying coal shipping. Germany's government decided in September to postpone the decommissioning of 2 out of 3 nuclear power plants in the country, saying it will keep the 2 plants running until at least April. Germany shut down 3 nuclear reactors in 2021, and shutting the remaining 3 would officially mark the end of the nuclear phase-out for domestic energy production. In the meantime, the Russia Today Daily reports national grid operator RTE warned on Friday, November 18th, France faces a greater risk of running short on electricity in January because the availability of the country's nuclear plants will probably be lower than previously forecast. RTE, which has been issuing updates of the situation on a monthly basis, also noted that decrease in the demand for power is making a shortage next month less likely than previously expected. RT claimed the situation appears less risky in December and from the end of February, but the month of January now concentrates more risks than in the previous analysis. Grid operator Electricité de France earlier warned that repairs and maintenance on almost half of the nation's nuclear plants may turn France, which has traditionally been a power exporter, into an importer this year. France generates roughly 70% of its electricity from 56 nuclear reactors. However, it had just 31 of them online on Friday morning, November 18th. EDF has plans to restart 15 units by the end of the year. with another 10 in the first 2 months of 2023. Some other reactors will have also be stopped for scheduled maintenance. The French government has called on businesses and households to conserve energy to avoid blackouts. In the event of a possible electricity shortage, RTE will launch an eco-watch red alert 3 days in advance, demanding reduced consumption. RTE says the risk of resorting to eco-watch system appears high in January. The grid operator warns it will largely depend on climate conditions such as a potential cold snap or even a moderate one. Furthermore, France Press News Agency writes, the price of electricity in Germany, France and Italy for 2023 has soared to new records due to the European energy crisis caused by the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. In Germany, the price of electricity for the year ahead reached €850 per megawatt hours in the stock market. The year ahead contract in France's bourse market passed €1,000 on Friday, November 18th. Compared to last year's price, €85 in both countries, the year-ahead contracts in both countries' markets indicate a stark rise in energy prices. Soaring energy prices coupled with runaway inflation have put the livelihood of Europeans under heavy constraints after the Europeans severed their energy ties with Russia, the main supplier of natural gas to Europe, over the Ukraine conflict triggering a dire economic crisis on the continent. The shutdown of several nuclear reactors in France due to corrosion issues has contributed to the electricity price increase as power production has dramatically decreased in the country. Also, Italy's oldest consumer association, ONC, reported on Thursday, November 17th, electricity prices in the country set an all-time record in October. Prices for electricity, which is being sold in the Apennine on the free market, have surged 329% since October last year and topped the ONC rating of the most expensive goods and services. International flights followed power tariffs with an annual increase in cost equaling 113%. Gas was the next in the ranking, with prices surging more than 96% compared to last year. Since the start of Russia's special operation in Ukraine in late February, Germany has offered substantial military support to Ukraine, sending the country billions of dollars in military aid and heavy weaponry. Russia has in turn cut off gas supplies to Europe, causing a worsening energy crisis. Germany, along with other European Union countries, is scrambling to support homes and industries burdened by a further surge in energy prices.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be looking at a question which a lot of people ask. And this question is about a topic called ignoring sin, or we call taghaful in Arabic. A lot of times people ask, they say that we've heard certain stories about Imam Ali alayhi salam, that when he would pass a certain place where a sin was taking place, he would ignore it, or that the Prophet would send him to a certain place to investigate whether a sin was being performed in that place, and the Imam would kind of ignore the sin going on, but he would close his eyes, or he would announce in a loud voice that he was coming and give the people a chance to stop sinning. I think these kind of things kind of have been mentioned, and it kind of indicates that this is something positive. But people ask, well, how does this tie up with Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahi al Munkar, enjoining the right and forbidding the evil? On the one hand, we should, you know, try to prevent people from sinning. At the same time, these kind of, you know, events which have been related indicate that, you know, it's good to ignore what's going on. You know, how do we reconcile these conflicting, recommendations, right? Right. So in general terms, we can say that ignoring this kind of sins and these kind of faults of people can be divided into two categories. In a certain cases, and these all depend on the conditions, you know, that are in which they're happening. And so we have a hadith which has been related from Imam the Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, Imam Ali, Imam Sajjad, Imam Bakr, Imam Sadiq. All of these people, all of these holy people, have mentioned this. In this hadith, right, the Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and you know the other ayma, they said that living with people in a peaceful manner is a pact that you make with them, two-thirds of which is awareness, it's tied up with awareness, and one-third of it is ignorance. I mean, so two-thirds of it is being aware of what's going on and, you know, observing, making sure that there's, you know, corruption is not occurring. You know, and here's where the Amr bil Ma'ruf, Nahi al Munkar comes in. And one-third of it is ignoring, you know, people's faults, ignoring their sins, ignoring their mistakes. So this first part of the hadith points towards that that negative ignorance of people's faults and mistakes, and the second part of it to the positive one. So these two are capable of being combined without any contradiction arising. Right? It all depends on the conditions, right, in which you know they are the thing, the sin and the mistake is occurring. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at ignoring people's faults and sins. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.